Welcome to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, Chief Communications Officer at Woodwell Climate Research Center, familiar to many by our former name, Woods Hole Research Center. And I'm thrilled to be back on CAI's airwaves today, sitting in the guest host chair for a conversation about the knowledge, the experience, and the leadership that we need to address climate change. Now, I work at a science organization, and I spent years as a science reporter. But there's a growing recognition that while science is absolutely necessary to address climate change, it alone is not sufficient. That there's a growing recognition of the link between climate change and social injustice. Developing nations and future generations, those who did least to cause climate change, bear the greatest brunt. There's ample evidence of that. Similarly, women globally and communities of color here in the U.S. are disproportionately impacted by climate change. In her new book, Diversifying Power, energy expert and social justice advocate Jenny Stevens makes the case that diverse leadership and anti-racist feminist policy priorities are key to addressing our climate and energy challenges. Jenny Stevens is the director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs and the Dean's Professor of Sustainability Science and Policy at Northeastern University. She is also the director for strategic research collaborations at Northeastern's Global Resilience Institute, and she's affiliated with the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies Program, the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and the Department of Cultures, Societies, and Global Studies. Quite a range of expertise there. Jenny Stevens, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Heather. Great to be on your show.
Now, I've heard climate change described as a market failure because we don't and we haven't taken things like pollution into account in our economic systems, at least not well. You say, in contrast, that climate change is a leadership failure. So describe what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I've been working on climate and energy issues for my whole career, so the past 20 years or so. And what I've found is that we have the technologies and we know what needs to happen in terms of transitioning away from fossil fuels toward a renewable-based society. But we haven't had the leadership to make that happen. And so I propose that we have a crisis in leadership. And part of that is because we have been focusing perhaps too much on the technological innovation and technology changes and not enough on the social innovation and social changes that are necessary. And when we do that, when we focus so much on the science and technology, we end up not paying enough attention also to the social justice implications of the policies that we are putting forward. So I really think we need to be centering all of our climate energy policies with social justice, racial justice, economic justice at the core. And I think that's when we will be able to usher in more transformative change. So I think that's kind of the key piece that we've been missing so far.
Now, you mentioned the disproportionate impacts of climate change on communities of color, and you actually argue in your book that this has not always been just an unintended consequence, as it's often viewed, but actually, in some cases, more engineered than that. So can you explain your view of how environmental racism has really been manifest?
Yeah, so it's really associated with this concentration of wealth and power, particularly in the United States over the past four decades. There has been a very intentional strategy for what some of us are now calling the polluter elite, part of the top 1% who are shareholders in fossil fuel companies and other wealthy individuals who are profiting from the current system. They actually don't want change for the public good. They want to continue to concentrate their wealth and power. And they have been strategically investing for decades in ways that many of us haven't even been aware of in resisting a transformation away from fossil fuels toward renewable energy. And in particular, they have been investing in a misinformation campaign to deny climate science. They've been investing to undermine public trust in government and to dismantle regulations that are designed to protect our health, and also minimizing worker protections and worker rights. And this has coincided with structural racism, that is so prevalent throughout our society, and then it has perpetuated this concentration of wealth and power, mostly among white elites who are profiting from the current system. So that's really the connection that that many of us, again, don't necessarily recognize, but more and more leaders who are aware of these interconnections of these different crises are acknowledging and revealing how these power dynamics have been playing out and really resulting in so many policies that are really not in the public interest and not in the public for the public good.
Climate change obviously is a global problem, and a lot of the issues and structures that you're talking about are somewhat U.S. specific, if not unique to the U.S. So how much of this is a U.S. problem in your mind, and how much of it is a more global, broader problem?
Yeah, so a lot of the same patterns we can see in other countries in the world, so it's not exclusive to the United States. The United States has had a particularly challenging situation with our leadership, including having, leadership that has denied not only the climate crisis, but also currently, denying the dangers of the pandemic, denying the economic crisis we're in, denying the structural racism and the racial injustices. So there's a pattern of kind of denying the truth and denying what's happening. So some of that is unique to the United States, but we also see, inspiring examples around the world of different kinds of leadership, and in particular, there's research that shows that countries led by women, who have more women leaders, have more ambitious climate policies. And if we think about the pandemic and the leadership right now in the pandemic, New Zealand, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, and other countries like Taiwan, Denmark, and Germany, also countries led by women, are among the countries that have been the most effective in managing the pandemic. And it seems like some of those leadership attributes include making decisive, evidence-based decisions and then communicating to the people why those measures are needed, and communicating in a trusted way with empathy and compassion to demonstrate that these measures are needed not just for the health of the individuals and families, but health of the whole community and the health of the country. So that's some of the same kind of leadership that we need to address the climate crisis as well.
You're listening to The Point. I'm guest host Heather Goldstone talking with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. Now, we're going to get to that anti-racist feminist leadership part specifically in just a minute, but you actually, in your book, frame this very broadly as kind of a choice between two worldviews, or at least two views of climate change, one that you call climate isolationism, which is where you say we have been, and the one you say we need to shift to, being energy democracy. So let's start with where we've been, climate isolationism. What is that?
Yeah, so for too long, I think we've been thinking about climate policy and climate change as this separate issue, right, that we often isn't at the top of our list of what we're worried about. And we've also embraced kind of a narrow technocratic lens to how we might solve or address the climate crisis, and that has focused on decarbonization, greenhouse gas emission reductions, and a kind of technological focus. That has been ineffective, and I think if we continue to think about the climate crisis in those ways only, we will continue to be ineffective. So I think what we need instead is to embrace kind of investments, the opportunities that we have to invest in communities, and particularly communities that have been underinvested for so long, as we transition away from fossil fuels toward a renewable future. So this is the idea of energy democracy, which is a vision of the future where we could have locally and regionally appropriate mixes of different renewable energy sources in different places. So places on the coast would have solar and wind, and they could also have wave and tidal and offshore wind. Inland communities could have wind and solar at different scales, but also geothermal energy, which is an energy source that we haven't yet invested a lot in. So when we invest in communities and in having this self-sufficiency and the possibilities of reliable, abundant, plentiful, renewable energy, it really is transformative, because we're literally and figuratively just redistributing power and taking back the power that these multinational fossil fuel energy companies have had on our policies and our politics. So that's the vision, and that's what increasingly we see, coalitions of multiracial, multigenerational coalitions coming together and asking for and demanding that we make these investments. And we focus not just on the climate impacts, but the lifestyle and jobs and economic justice issues, and connect it with housing and other investments in that we need desperately in terms of our country right now.
So I'm curious, when you say, as in the subtitle of your book, that we need anti-racist feminist leadership on climate and energy, does that, in your mind, mean crafting climate policies, energy policies, specifically with racial justice and gender equality and these other social issues taken into account, essentially just energy policies? Or does that actually mean, in your mind, that if we just took care, and I say just, it's obviously not a small challenge, but if we took care of the social issues and had more diverse leadership, that the climate and energy policy would just kind of take care of itself?
Yes, well, I think both are playing a role here. And when I call for anti-racist feminist leadership, I mean leadership that acknowledges the structural issues that have led to gender and racial inequities, and so there's that enables us to center social justice at the core of our policies. And I think it's very important to point out that anyone, regardless of your gender or your racial identification or your religion or cultural perspective, can embrace anti-racist feminist principles. And there's the other piece of what I'm calling for also, is that representation also does matter. Because when women, people of color, and indigenous folks are given opportunities and they're invited into leadership spaces where they have been historically excluded, we bring different priorities, different life experiences, and different perceptions of risk, and that those differences end up contributing to and allow a very different sensibility and capacity to center social justice, racial justice, and economic justice at the core of the policies that we are making. So it's a multifaceted argument here, but I think it's increasingly clear that if we need to broaden the conversations and the policies on climate and energy, and especially right now during the pandemic, where we're going to have big public investments to recover. It's so important that we have diverse leadership guiding those investments, to make sure that we don't inadvertently perpetuate and exacerbate the inequities that we see, because that is what has been happening with much climate and energy policy. If you think about rooftop solar incentives, for example, many of those, a lot of public support has gone to wealthy, more well-off families to put solar panels on their roof, which is great, and they benefit from that. But it ends up exacerbating inequities between, because lower income households who have a much higher energy burden haven't had access to that, and so that has actually widened economic injustice and the economic gaps. So what we need is policies that are explicitly focused on ensuring that the incentives and the public investments go to the communities and households and families that have been historically underinvested in for too long.
That's Jenny Stevens of Northeastern University. Her new book is Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. We're going to continue our conversation and bring in some new voices in just a few minutes. We also want to hear from you this hour. What perspectives do you wish were better represented in local and national leadership? And how do you think our climate policies would be different if we had more diverse leadership? We'll open the phones later this hour, but you can email us now, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I'm Heather Goldstone, guest hosting this hour of The Point. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone of Woodwell Climate Research Center, guest hosting today's conversation about the role of diverse leadership and anti-racist and feminist policy priorities in addressing climate change. I've been talking with Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power: Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. We're joined now by a couple of additional voices. Mathavi Venkatesan is the founder and executive director of Sustainable Practices, a Cape Cod-based nonprofit fostering a culture of sustainability and stewardship. She is an academic economist and environmental activist who has authored 3 textbooks on sustainable economics and teaches the economics of sustainability and race at Northeastern University. Also joining us, Leslie Jonas, vice chairwoman of Native Land Conservancy and a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Eel Clan. She puts her interest in the rescue, restoration, and preservation of precious lands and water into action in her personal as well as professional life, and works to create awareness about climate change from Indigenous perspectives. So glad both of you could join us.
Thank you for having us.
Leslie, you shared your perspective on climate change at the recent Net Zero conference organized by Cape Cod Climate Change Collaborative. It was a really powerful presentation, and I wonder if you could share a bit of that perspective with us now.
Sure. Well, I think just following on the heels of what Jenny Stevens just shared, the situation has on climate change has always been one of denial from those leaders that she was referencing. And what I've tried to do over the last couple of years is open our eyes to the fact that so many different groups are impacted, especially Indigenous people, and especially Indigenous people from the coastlines, especially with the onset of sea rise. So I think what my focus is in these presentations is to not only highlight some of the obvious evidence that we've all been witnessing for many, many years now, but how we address it and how we work together to come up with solutions that serve everybody and not just a few. So it's this cross-collaborative, cross-cultural, intercultural collaborative work that I speak to, that we have to be at the table where these climate change discussions and solutions are being talked about and developed.
Leslie, one of the things that I heard you say at that conference was also about just the knowledge systems and how we understand what climate change is, what's causing it, how the impacts are playing out. And a lot of that has come from our mainstream, predominantly white, predominantly male science. And your perspective provides perhaps a complement or alternative. I wonder how you would kind of describe what you see as the ideal relationship between some of the different knowledge systems for understanding the fundamental problem of climate change.
Well, just looking at how leadership and has changed on the topic as well, including women and people of color now, which is trending for many reasons. But I'm reaching out and working with local and state groups and networks to move away from a relationship of exploitation when we include Indigenous and people of color, and to one of more shared value relationships. We're all looking to do very similar things in this climate change work that we're involved in. One of them includes for Native people what's called TEC, traditional ecological knowledge, or Native science, which is really incredibly valuable. And what I'd like to see happen more is a cross collaboration between TEC and traditional Western science and technology, working together. Indigenous people understand and have witnessed and lived in a world of climate change that's impacted us greatly. Loss of land, loss of water, loss of access. So what Jenny Stevens talks a lot about is just so important, because we have to have a voice to not only describe the impacts, but how we can help to be part of the solution. We see and live what the impacts are. And so if we could bring together the two different sciences and work toward the solutions together, it would serve everybody and, of course, most importantly, our Earth Mother.
Jenny Stevens, you touch on the idea that not only do we need greater diversity in leadership, but greater diversity in the science community. How important do you think that is to being able to address climate change effectively?
Absolutely. That's so important. And as Leslie mentioned, and it's great to be on having this conversation, thank you for bringing us all together. What I've experienced in my own academic scientific training is a priority and a hierarchy of different kinds of knowledge, and I think that is to our detriment. Even in my own experience in working in energy and going to energy conferences, often there'd be just a handful of women at these conferences, and we'd get to know each other and network. And what we realized is that we bring different life experiences, different perceptions of what's important and different priorities. So if and when we have more inclusive and science, we actually will prioritize different things. So I think it's critical, and the possibilities for the integration of different forms of knowledge, including, as Leslie mentioned, Native science, is so rich and essential to moving forward in a way that really is able to respect and be participatory and inclusive in a collaborative way that will lead to better policies and strategies and investments to lead to more prosperous and inclusive outcomes for everybody.
Mathavi Venkatesan, I want to bring you in here. You are an economist, as Jenny's mentioning, more potentially profitable, more beneficial models in society. Your nonprofit, Sustainable Practices, really seems to embody this kind of holistic view of climate as an environmental and social issue. Where does that come from, in your economic background? Where does that view come from for you?
Sure. Basically, my background started in academics, but I moved on to industry, and then I came back to academics. And then during my time period in industry, I saw very clearly how my economics background was really playing a complete role in terms of endogenizing the economic model. And what I mean by that is, in economics, we have two basic theories that the whole world revolves around. One is a theory of the consumer, which is the consumer seeks to maximize or gratify their individual interests, and the theory of the firm, where we're looking for profit maximization and cost minimization. When you take those two elements and you try to think about sustainability, or you look at climate change, there's a direct correlation. And that's basically what we're doing with our nonprofit, but on a much smaller scale. So if you don't mind, I'll just explain really quickly. I mean, when we look at how we've been taught to behave in our market system, to look out for what maximizes our gratification at a single moment without thinking about the cost or the exploitation that underlies that, the market is not making observable to us, but not feeling that we have a responsibility to understand that supply chain, that's one. When we're looking for immediate gratification in terms of our pension accounts increasing or retirement funds increasing, but not taking into consideration why they're increasing, because they're increasing because we're minimizing costs by externalizing on the most vulnerable. That explains why in the last basically 80 years, ever since the GDP metric has become the standard metric for economic progress on a global scale, we have seen a trajectory in terms of slope with that GDP value on a global scale matching the trajectory of the CO2 or carbon emissions that we attribute to the speed of climate change today. So there is an economic element to this, but the economic element is related to focusing on metrics and divesting ourselves of moral judgment within the exercise of those metrics. So if I could just very briefly say, we all learn supply and demand when you take a simple economics course, but very, very rarely, unless perhaps you have an instructor who's focused on it, does that instructor tell you that your demand function also incorporates your moral perspective. If we actually started teaching that more directly, that our responsibility in our consumption was also aligned to our responsibility towards our supposed values, and if we actually instituted national values related to specifically a moral perspective on how we treat each other and the environment, there could be a lot of changes fairly quickly. And that's basically what we're doing on a life cycle basis at Sustainable Practices. We're focused on the life cycle of single-use plastic water bottles. Embodied in that is the exploitation at every single stage and the long-term externalized consequences to future generations because of a lack of thoughtfulness related to that 5-10 minute amount of gratification from drinking that single-use beverage.
And I'm really interested in hearing this kind of focus on moral consumption. And Jenny Stevens, I'm wondering, like, as you're hearing that, your response, I mean, what is the individual responsibility, especially when we're talking about something as global as climate change and something as systemic as racial inequality in this country? What's the individual responsibility versus how much of this needs to be addressed at a more structural level?
Yeah, I think it's really important for us to collectively reveal and acknowledge and elevate the structural elements because that's what's going to lead to transformative change, I think. I think we as individuals, we can all make choices and some of us have more freedom to make choices than others. And so I think there is a delicate balance there, and I think it's really important to expand the conversations about climate and environment and sustainability beyond individual choice, because so many people, especially when we're thinking about the injustices in our society, don't have choices to make and really are very limited and constrained. So that's where the focus on kind of bigger systemic change is really important. But having said that, there's a literature and an academic area of transition studies, understanding how big societal transformation happens, and it's really important that what that literature and that theory demonstrates or calls for is that big structural changes happen when there's alignment with innovative things happening in the at the experimental level in local places and individuals making changes, and then there's a big disruption in the status quo, and then there's also like macro level disruptions that are allowing for change. And I think that you could argue that that's where we are right now with the pandemic is really a disruptive force in kind of broadening the possibilities for deeper change because so much is being disrupted, including our consumption patterns and our individual lifestyle choices that we're making. We've all made choices and changed our lives in ways that we would never have imagined a year ago, right? So I think that speaks also to what Madhavi was saying also in terms of how we, the the conventional assumptions about what choices we can make and what different choices we could make if we were in a different framework are really, really important to be elevating.
You're listening to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, guest hosting today's conversation about the role of diversity, anti-racism, and feminism in addressing climate change. We invite you to join us and share your thoughts on how climate policy might look different if we had more diverse leadership and opportunities for action that you see at the intersection of climate change and social justice. You can call us at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to go to the phones right now. We have Julian Sear, State Senator for the Cape and Islands District since 2016, on the phone. He's the Senate Assistant Majority Whip, Chair of the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use and Recovery, and the youngest senator in the 40-member body. Julian, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Heather. Happy Veterans Day. And I am the youngest member now, but we just we had a colleague elected in North Central Massachusetts who is 30. So I'm going to be surrendering my tiara as the youngest member of the Senate. I'll have to change that bio, but I've got it for a few more weeks. So until he's sworn in at the beginning of January.
Too bad about losing the title, but great that there's more youth and diversity joining the Senate.
Exactly.
So I wonder your thoughts. I mean, you work on through the committees that you're on, right? A number of social issues, from healthcare policy, public health, education. How do you see this intersection of climate change and social justice, especially being a senator from a place that is very clearly impacted by climate change already?
Well, certainly when we look at the climate crisis, this is existential for Cape Codders and for Islanders, right? How we make our life here actually is already changing, and it's going to change pretty significantly, really in response to a lack of leadership, certainly at the national level, at the international level, and a real failure of our existing leaders and the historical leaders we've had, who grossly disproportionately are male. Many of whom in this country are white, who are straight, who are people of wealth and means, and so this certainly is real for Cape Codders. I think for me, I really try to embrace and to bring a queer feminist lens to the work that I do as someone who is LGBTQ, one of a few out members in the legislature. And although I am male identified, I really try to embrace a feminist lens, because I think there's a real value, and I also try to embrace a racial justice perspective, because I think the experience of having been left out is something that is really valuable when you're in a leadership position, right? When you are entrusted with the faith of your constituents, in the case of the legislature, which we are given that privilege to do. For me, having that experience of being someone who is left out is something that really, I think, informs my leadership. I think it makes me a better leader. And I think I've also had to adapt and learn how to communicate in a certain way. Having those, tougher conversations, more honest conversations with people. Earlier you were talking about, there seems to be some evidence that countries that are led by women, are taking a more honest, progressive, science-based approach to, the climate crisis. And I would argue I see that play out and manifest among my colleagues in the legislature, right? So, I see that in the leadership of Senate President Karen Spilka. I see that in the leadership of the women who I'm serving with in the legislature. We have more we have more women serving the legislature now than ever, but it's still only a third. And so I think for climate change, for the climate crisis, and for all these really tough issues, we need more women at the table. We need more queer folks at the table. We need more people of color at the table. Yes, to be to sort of more honestly fulfill the promise of the American democratic experiment, but also because I think those people bring a lens and experience that actually results in better leadership and better policy.
Well, Senator Sear, I know you've got a busy day. I want to thank you for joining us for a few minutes this morning to share your thoughts on this topic.
Heather, thank you so much for covering this, and fascinating to listen to Jenny Stevens and her work. Enjoy the beautiful weather while we've got it. It certainly doesn't feel like November these last few days, but maybe the universe has been telling us something, or maybe we're just living in the terrifying effects of climate change. But anyway, take good
care. It definitely could be. Thank you so much, Senator Sear. And you too can join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626 is our phone number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tell us what perspectives you wish were better represented in leadership and how you think that would affect our climate policies. And share some of your ideas for addressing climate change and racial justice at the same time. Again, that's 866-999-4626 or thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll return to our conversation with our guests and with you after a short break. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone of Woodwell Climate Research Center, guest hosting today for a great conversation today about the role of diverse leadership and a social justice lens in addressing climate change. We started the hour with Jenny Stevens of Northeastern University, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. And Jenny is still with us. We also have Leslie Jonas of Native Land Conservancy and member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, and Mathavik Venkatesan of Northeastern University and the Cape-based advocacy group Sustainable Practices. We also just heard from State Senator Julian Sear, and we have on the line State Representative Sarah Peek from Provincetown. She's been serving the people of the 4th Barnstable District since 2007. And Representative Peek, welcome to the show.
Heather, thank you. I'm glad to be invited to join you for a few minutes this morning.
Absolutely. Glad to have you. And wondering what jumps out at you, your thoughts on this topic of the intersection of social justice and climate change.
Right. Just a quick aside before I take up that question. I'm on the road today, so I'm unable to spend the morning with the veterans in my district. I want to acknowledge today as Veterans Day and thank the women and men who have served this country with honor and dignity, and to let them know that I'm thinking about them, even if I can't be with them at their ceremonies, virtual or not, this morning. Now, to get to your question, I think as a general principle, the more diverse group of people that you can have sitting around a table where policy is being discussed, the better off we are. Specific to climate change, as I was thinking about this, when the legislature took up the first large renewable energy bill, the one that really created the opportunity for the deep water offshore wind projects, that got most of the focus. But there was also information in there about solar credits and all of that. And I think somewhat inadvertently, probably because there is a disproportionately small number of minority members in the state legislature, a disproportionately small number of women in the state legislature, we somehow cut the knees out from under the program that would enable less affluent neighborhoods, public housing projects, that type of thing, to be able to install solar panels, get off their oil-spewing, carbon-spewing current heating system.
I think we may have lost Representative Peek. Are you there? Yes, I think we've lost Representative Peek. She did say she was on the road. We'll see if we can get her back. But again, we do have three guests with us this morning. Jenny Stevens of Northeastern University, author of Diversifying Power, Leslie Jonas of Native Land Conservancy, and Mathavi Venkatesan, also Northeastern University and Sustainable Practices, the nonprofit that she has formed. And I would love to hear from all three of you, you know, as we've been hearing from both Senator Sear and Representative Peek, the relative lack of diversity in our elected officials, but at the same time, I would say our leadership and elected officials are more diverse than ever. I mean, in the past 10 years, we've seen first Black president, first Muslim and Native American congresswomen at the federal level, now first woman and woman of color to be elected vice president. But at the same time, we are living in what feels like an increasingly more and more polarized political situation. How do you see this idea of needing more diverse leadership kind of intersecting with that polarization? I mean, is it part and parcel? Is it a solution to? And Jenny Stevens, we'll start with you.
Sure. Well, thank you. And it was great to hear from our state reps and state senator. I think I would encourage us to think about the squad, the four junior congresswomen who have come on the national stage and really changed the conversation with regard to climate and energy by explicitly connecting it with jobs and economic justice and housing and racial justice and with the proposal of the Green New Deal, it's become clear how there are opportunities for addressing these issues together. And you mentioned the polarization, and which is really unfortunate because it's again it's quite intentional and strategic to kind of vilify and demonize this idea that our government can make investments to help everybody. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done in reframing and also showing people and actually following through with demonstrating that investments in communities can help everybody and not thinking of it as like a negative thing. And I think I'm also inspired really by the youth movement and younger leaders being active. The Sunrise Movement has been critical in the election that we just had in terms of mobilizing and catalyzing the youth engagement in our electoral process. And you know, young people are looking to the future, and they're not seeing a very bright possibilities ahead, right? Not just the climate crisis, but looking at job prospects and the economy and how the world is going. And so young people are really concerned. I have two daughters myself who are 19 and 21, and I see them looking at the world ahead, and they're concerned, right? And I think that is also another way where we can break down the divisiveness by listening to the youth and listening and thinking about longer term and thinking about the future and the kind of investments we need to make now to pave a positive and productive and regenerative future for everybody. And we really need investments in our communities across the board in health, education, housing, transportation, and job creation. And a lot of that we can connect with a transformation away from fossil fuels toward a renewable-based future.
Mathavi Venkatesan, I wonder how you kind of grapple with these perhaps competing trends or opposite trends of increasing diversity in elected leadership, but also increasing polarization in our political system and our political discourse.
Well, actually, it goes back to something I said earlier, which is I brought up just briefly the power of individual behavior, but my organization is a coalescing of individual behavior, which is basically a grassroots movement. And if we go back to a very famous quote that we all are pretty much familiar with from Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. I believe what you're seeing when you see these women of diversity or having diverse backgrounds or people of any kind of diversity in an organization that's representing multiple communities, like if we look at the government level, what you're seeing is a grassroots movement at their individual level where they were elected into office that made that change, that promoted the ability for this diversity. But what really is more important than diversity is inclusiveness. So if you don't have a stakeholder engagement model that actually puts inclusivity before it puts diversity, you can have a lot of diverse people, but they may not be heard. So this is one of the biggest challenges, I think, because unfortunately we have this discussion, but we talk about diversity first, inclusion second. But inclusivity, by its definition, will allow the voices of whoever is in the room to be heard. So we really need to start focusing on inclusivity before diversity, and that inclusivity really begins at the grassroots level. And a simple example, and I'm really a strong proponent of grassroots from that simple perspective, because when you're talking about grassroots, you're talking about individuals understanding why the changes need to be made and pushing for those changes. Grassroots elect people into office that then become reflective of those grassroots movements. So therefore, regulation works because the people already want it. It codifies a change that's already being understood. We have multiple examples in the history of this country where we have regulated to create a change and missed the mark of our intention. And that's because we haven't necessarily explained and educated why those changes need to be made. Given the amount of differences that we see in terms of educational understanding of these different issues, some of them can be tied to partisan politics, we have our work cut out for us. But what we really need to have is a common theme that everybody understands, buys into, regardless of what other elements rule their alignment and their day-to-day behavior, that this common theme is something that we all aspire to. We can't be partisan on a common theme. So we only have a few minutes, and I know I don't want to take too much of the time, but the concept of stakeholder engagement really underlies all of this. It's not necessarily that women are the dominant elements of causing sustainability or promoting change on these issues. It's that women who have been marginalized and who get into leadership positions reflect more than likely a growing grassroots constituency that understands that the value is not based on gender. So they're more of a proxy of an underlying change in perceptions to some extent. I don't think we should oversimplify to a level of just saying gender or color. We should look at why that gender and color becomes represented, when it hasn't been historically before, because it really is giving us an indicator of a social change on a different level that's put those people in power. So that would be my little bit that I'd like to share in this conversation. And I wish we had so much more time, because I think there's so many things that are worthwhile discussing here.
Absolutely. And as you said, we are running short on time. And I want to make sure, Leslie Jonas, that we get to you and just kind of when you look at where we are in terms of our national politics and the issues both of social justice and climate change, I guess what's kind of your high level assessment of where we are and where we seem to be headed?
Thank you. I think the concept of inclusivity over diversity is so powerful and important, and I love how that was just shared. Thank you so much. And I think that lends itself toward the continued, it's slow, but dismantling of white supremacy in this country, which has led to the extreme racism in white politics that we've all suffered. Including many white people who are evolved and inclusive, if you will. What's needed is clearly what we've all been saying is, you know, more equitable involvement of women and people of color. I look at it as it relates to land conservation and forest management, and by including women and people of color in this area, it will lead to significant greater improvements in our forest conditions. And this has been proven because the issues and the needs are more fully addressed and represented. So we look to, you know, our youth, as we were just talking about as well, our next generation, and how are we educating and preparing them? This is a very concerning topic for a lot of different communities because of what we've witnessed happening, which is the age of technology just sort of taking over and taking our kids out of the outside world.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. That is Leslie Jonas of Native Land Conservancy. We also were joined by Methevi Venkatesan of Northeastern University and Sustainable Practices, her nonprofit, and also Jenny Stevens, author of Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. Thank you all for joining us this morning. I'm Heather Goldstone, guest hosting this morning on The Point.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.